Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
To Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're coming to you from the International Culinary Center in Soho, and we're taking a breath. We're going to not have a chef. I think this is the first time we're not having a chef as our interviewee. We've done about close to 100 shows, and I think it's time to take stock. And I've invited one of my dear friends, a professional I hugely admire, and he also happens to be the Dean of Journalism here at the ICC. But Alan Richman, my great writing hero, is the most decorated food writer, actually, in history. Do you know that? Well, in history. Wait. You won 15 James Beard Awards. 16 James Beard Awards.
You're not updating, Dorothy.
Okay. A National Magazine Award, and you were a finalist 5 times.
Right.
And this is what I love. You got a Bronze Star for service in Vietnam.
I mean, you can't do different things in life. You can't do all the same thing. You know, you can't just eat.
Okay. Well, you have been reviewing restaurants mainly for GQ for how many years?
Well, for GQ for about 26, 27 years. But before that, when I was doing other journalism jobs, I was always writing about food on the side. What astonished me, it took me so long to figure out that food was what I really liked to write about.
So you were even a sports writer, correct? So give us your creds as a writer. You know, what made you a writer and what makes a writer? What kind of technical skills and schooling?
Suffering. That's what makes a writer. Writing it seems like it should be easy. One story out of 100 is easy. But most of the time, you sit down and you suffer. You know, you're drawing blood when you're writing stories. Because you want them to be great. At least the old-time guys like me want them to be great. And you have your own vision of what is great. And, of course, your editor doesn't have the same vision you have. So you have to battle through it. And what seems to be an effortless process, if it comes out well, is really one of the torturous things you can do.
What are the basic skills a writer needs? And because we'll maybe at the end of the program get into today's writing. But what are the basic skills that a good writer needs?
I always think for me it's a poor memory in the sense that I go off, I investigate the story, I get amazing amounts of information. You've got to be a reporter. Let me just say it. Reporting is everything. People have forgotten that, but reporting is the key to good stories. But then when it's over, it's almost like you have to forget everything you did because you're starting out on a completely different story that has nothing to do with the last one. And everything you learn has to be cleared from your mind so you can start out fresh again. I think one of my real virtues as a writer is I can continually see things from a fresh perspective, even though I'm not the youngest guy in the world.
That is interesting. Because does that mean you can't bring any preconceived opinion to the piece?
Well, you bring, if you're a critic, as I often am, you bring your perceived notions of what food should taste like. But other than that, you really have to be totally open-minded. You really do. I mean, especially today when the world is changing so much, the food world is changing. So all your ideas of what food used to be and what you used to love and the way you wish it used to be, you have to forget about that or you're just going to have no success whatsoever. You have to come to everyone saying, everything's going to be new, everything's going to be different, and you have to embrace that. You also can reject it in criticism if you think they do a bad job, but you have to go into it with great enthusiasm.
Okay, so I invited you here today to really talk about how we, the public, are perceiving chefs today, because we can only perceive them through the prism of media. Good. And, you know, we have the Food Network where some are on television, but our big restaurant chefs, the Thomas Kellers, the David Changs, you know, the Dan Barbers, they're not on television. We get their personas and a glimpse into their restaurant from the media. How do you see that restaurant reviewing and chef reviewing has changed in the last 20 years?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the era of the big, grandiose, great chef is going to disappear. You know, the era of Daniel Boulud, of Jean-Georges Van Richten, of Eric Ripert, I think it's just a limited time for those kind of restaurants and those kind of powerful, important, greatly, greatly loved and greatly, greatly accomplished chefs to survive. I think we're going to more, just the way the internet has caused the writing to be smaller bits from billions of people, I think we're going to eventually go into era of smaller restaurants from billions of new chefs, and many of them great, you know, many and more of them doing what they want to do, their own. I'm not sure it's always the best thing in the world. I think training certainly beats inspiration almost every time, but I'm just telling you what it's going to be, not what I want it to be. So I think there's going to be a lot more small inspirational restaurants all over the place. The thing that goes against that, of course, is rents. Can these chefs afford to open these small places? But when they can, and I think they still can, even in New York, I think that's the trend that's going to show up. And as I was saying, it reminds me of the internet, where everybody writes tiny blogs and everybody writes tiny pieces. Everything's becoming more diffuse.
Why didn't that happen 20 years ago when the rents were cheaper?
You know, I think we were still then in the era of the great chef. And you know, today, most of us, and I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, most of us have discredited the idea of the chain restaurant. Of, you know, even a great chef like Andrew Carmellini opens restaurant after restaurant after restaurant, and by now we know they're not going to be great.
Oh, Little Park is great. I was just there. It's his brand new restaurant. Oh, we love to fight, Alan. You see, Little Park in Tribeca, and it's a vegetable. It's a vegetable restaurant. I had the best celery root, you know, steak there. But anyway, so go on.
No, well, you know, if Andrew Carmellini, who, you know, is a great, great chef, if he has finally opened up a great restaurant from his many restaurants, it can happen, and I'm so pleased. I'm not saying this because I want it to be this way. I'm saying this because it is this way. I haven't been to Little Park, so I haven't tried.
We're going together.
All right, I'll go. I'll sneer when you order the celery root steak. Dorothy, that's a celery root. That's not a steak. Anyway, but I still think, why didn't it happen years ago? We hadn't entered this. We weren't ready for it yet. You know, the guy who may have started this was David Chang in a minute. He started so many things. I know you want to talk about David because you love to talk about David. But you know, he was a great chef who opened small restaurants. He started out with tiny restaurants and went from there. Now he's going bigger now, the new Momofuku Ko.
Well, why I wanted to talk about David was a lot of people write about him. And how is he written about today by bloggers and other media? And how is it different from if he had opened a restaurant 15 years ago and how the media would have written about him then?
You mean if he had opened a major, big, grandiose restaurant like everybody did and become the conventional way of going about it? You know, he is treated with great reverence. I mean, he still is. I have yet to read an article trashing Chang. I mean, when you look at his accomplishments, all these restaurants he opened in New York, I haven't been to the ones in Australia, the one in Toronto, but everybody says it's good. And he says they're good. So he really understands how to put together a kitchen and a restaurant staff, which astounds me because he's so unconventional. You think he would not know how to do that. But apparently he does it awfully well. He's so intensely involved in what everybody is doing in his restaurants and how well they work and how well they work together to an extent I've almost never seen in my life. Not that I've spent tons of time with chefs the way you have, but I'm impressed with that. But he's also the hero because, you know, he's the counterculture guy, even though he's not so counterculture anymore. And so he goes to these food fairs and he's the star. He has a magazine, Lucky Peach, where he gives work to journalists. Everybody wants from work. They're not going to be mean to him anymore.
David, he's pitching you.
No. You know what happens when I see Chang? He sees me and he says, I was in his restaurant at Momofuku-ko and he happened to be in there. He says, when are you taking me to lunch at La Bernardine? That's what he doesn't offer. He wants me to spend money. He doesn't want to give me money. So I wrote a profile. I like him tremendously and I think he's astoundingly talented guy. You know, one of the things I've noticed about him, all his lieutenant, you know, I always thought it was kind of a communal, like a communist affair in his restaurants where everybody worked together and everybody was equal. But you know, the lieutenants that have gone out from him and opened up their own restaurants, they've done okay, but not one has been a star. And what says to me, the star is Chang, and he is the star of that show.
So he's one of those chefs that has a chain now, right? And it's been successful. Yes. But you were talking to me a bit about you read five profiles on him.
And well, I read five stories in Lucky Peach, all of which won James Beard Award last year because I was curious about that. And they weren't profiles of him.
Oh, okay.
Although I've read many profiles of him, they're all gloriously glowing, so there's not much to say. No, I was talking about the fact that I read those from the point of view of seeing how food writing has changed in America and everywhere, I think.
How so?
Well, I mean, I'm a little grumpy about this, if I'm allowed to be. I come from an era of journalism. I don't think of myself as a food writer. I think of myself as a food journalist. And ways to write journalism. And I think they're disappearing. Because nobody cares, and I think that's going to be a real problem.
Why? Why? If people are enjoying what they're reading, and the convention has fallen away, what was it about the convention that you think now is lacking? How are we suffering?
Well, so but maybe it's just me that's suffering, and not everybody else out there. But I'm suffering because I look for well-crafted, well-written stories that express feelings, that express, give you a personality picture of somebody, that really beautifully write about a subject that they've sent out to cover, that are like complete tomes of almost literature. But I don't see that anymore. I see that everybody's writing sort of hip-hop music of journalism. I mean, if you go to it starts with the blogs where everything is either awful or awesome. You know, that's not a description. That's just somebody screaming something. I look at the fact that everybody has to create a whole new structure. The conventional structure of one paragraph following another doesn't seem that useful anymore or that well-loved anymore. I just don't see stories that move me. I see entertainment. I see a lot of writing that reminds me of the old 1970s gonzo journalism, which was kind of a stream of consciousness, a stream of ridiculousness, which I never liked when it was journalism, though, you know, the famous person for this was Tom Wolfe, even though he wasn't a food writer. And he wrote nonfiction journalism that way, and I hated it. And then he wrote books that way, and I loved it, because to me it's not journalism. But I'm seeing a lot of journalism written in this style where you spew out what's within you, what you're seeing, what you're thinking, and that doesn't communicate anything to the reader. It's self-indulgent, and it's not useful.
So are you railing against the brevity of the pieces, the bloggers, the fact that it's not written on a piece of paper. I mean, there are thousands of bloggers. There has to be some that graduated in English from Harvard that knows how to string three paragraphs together.
They do not. They do not know how to string.
It's like you're railing against the screen as opposed to paper.
No, I hope not. I don't, because I think the screen is the future of journalism, of food journalism and food writing. I mean, all magazines have peaked. I mean, I hope they all do well. I hope they stick around. There's going to be small examples of magazines that are going to prosper and thrive. But the idea of a magazine as a full-blown, expansive future with we're going to get bigger and bigger and better and better and make more and more money, I don't think that exists. I just think that's over with. I think certainly there will be magazines, but there's not going to be mega magazines. There's not going to be a People magazine on paper, you know, that 30 million people read, and the income from
it's not going to have its influence like in the old days. Right. It's not going to have the followership, but we will have that on the internet.
Yes. That's why I say I am for the internet. I would just like to see the internet embrace what journalism is. And of course, one of the reasons it doesn't is because it doesn't have editors. There's very few editors on the internet. You write it and it's posted. And I'm someone who believes in editing. I'm someone who believes in having a story.
You're online.
Yeah, but I had editors. When I was online, when I'm online, I get edited.
Okay, so there are some good things being written.
GQ has editors. Yes.
All right. The New Yorker's online.
Do they write online stories? You know, I don't even know that. I think you have to subscribe to it, don't you?
The New York Times is online.
They just publish their stories.
The question is, how long an article will people read these days? How in-depth will they be? I was just thinking as you were talking, the power of social media, which is really, I think, what you're saying. Anybody can get on a Yelp and be a restaurant reviewer as opposed to a thoughtful restaurant review.
Right.
But, you know, there is a tremendous power in that social media that someone can tweet about a restaurant and it can go viral and affect a lot of people. And is that inherently wrong? Because if you look at political movements, the Arab Spring, that was brought on by social media, of people tweeting. Now, this wasn't thoughtful professors of politics saying this is right or wrong. Let me tell you who's right. It gives a tremendous amount of power to the people. And if you put it to our little restaurant world, tweeting is the same kind of thing. It's like rising up and saying, I have a voice. Even though I'm not that educated, I know what I like. I know what my palate likes. And I'm not writing for you foodies out there. I'm writing for, you know, the people in my neighborhood who, you know, have the same kind of palate as I do. So it's almost the democratization of saying, who do you want to follow? It's being a brand. No longer do you write for a magazine that has a brand. Alan Richman is a brand. I think people follow you more than they follow the magazine or the publications you write for.
The problem with this is you're right. There's something very glorious about this democratization that's brought about by the internet. I hate to drop names, but I was in Tahrir Square when it all started.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah, I was there. I sent all my friends a picture. There was billions of pictures taken. Did you know this? From helicopters looking down on them, tens of thousands of people packed into Tahrir Square. And I sent the copies of that to all my friends with a note, spot the Jew in this picture.
But what were you doing then?
I was writing a story, and it was, and I went, and you know, I heard, I went to write about, you know, the Arab Spring and about, but hopefully from a food point of view, which didn't work out so well. But I just went there, and I just walked over there, and this was a famous first day of Tahrir Square when everything went crazy. You know what? I had a good time. It was fun. Anyway, we're away with it. But the problem was, look. Okay, I think I've got you here. I think I've trapped you. You've trapped yourself here. The Arab Spring. What happened to the Arab Spring? It failed because the people didn't know what they were doing. Okay? Now, what happens with food writing when you have people who don't know what they're doing sending out these tweets that go viral? the wrong restaurants, the wrong people get celebrated. I think it's the same problem. You're right, there's beauty in the event, and it's fabulous how it can work, and it's fabulous how someone with 300,000 followers could change the world. But do they know what they're talking about?
All right, we're going to get into it, Alan, because the opposite of that is take the New York Times, and you have one reviewer who goes in after someone has had their parents mortgage their house. They've worked for 3 years putting this restaurant together. They have their life, their reputation, everything in it, and someone comes in for three meals and gives it one star. Or satisfactory. And you know what? Who says that that reporter even understands the concept? If the concept is a little modern, this is that person. And that one review will shut down that whole restaurant. That is like royal autocracy.
Okay, you're right about something. Okay.
So it's the opposite. I think there's somewhere in the between that we might.
But in that case, you're right. Though you know, the problem is if it's a reviewer, you're right about the fact that every reviewer has his own loves and likes and dislikes, and it's so hard to if you get the wrong reviewer in the wrong place, it can be a disaster, and in a place where the New York Times is so damn important, which is this city, it can be tragic if you get the wrong guy coming in at the wrong time.
And it's just one review, one person's opinion, albeit, and then that person has a palate like no one else's because no one has that expense account or stomach. No one will put themselves through that misery of having to eat out at five restaurants. And I mean, that palate is so far away from an average palate, one could argue, is it really relevant?
Yeah, and also, you know, the fact is the New York Times, I'm going to get in trouble. Pete Wells is a superb reviewer. I'm not talking about him. The New York Times has this weird way of picking its reviewers. All of a sudden, it has guys, and it just promotes them to the job. You're the New York Times restaurant reviewer, and you almost go from zero to a million miles an hour. I mean, Frank Bruni, who I thought ended up as a fabulous restaurant reviewer, I thought he was great at the end, was terrible at the beginning. So if he made mistakes at the beginning because he didn't know what he was doing, people suffered from that, I'm sure. It can be that kind of thing. At the end, I said to him when he quit to do other things, I said, you're a fool. I said to Frank, you're a fool. You're going to be the best restaurant reviewer in history if you just keep it up. And he didn't want to do it.
We have to take a break here. Right. We're coming back. I've got to go get a glass of water. I got to keep up with this guy.
Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street, Napa, and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Alan Richman, the most decorated food writer in history. He is a journalist extraordinaire, winning 16 James Beard Journalism Awards.
And about time you got it right.
National Magazine Award. And anyway. All right, so we've just said the New York Times has too much power. And I even think that's with Broadway, those critics can close a show. You've got a lot of power. And you know what? People do read, you know, chefs quake when you come in their restaurant. And do
beginning
you...
Beginning and the end of my power. go ahead.
But all right. Yeah, but how guilty do you feel when you write a bad review of how this is going to hurt, financially hurt, emotionally hurt, bust someone's dream? I mean, that is that. I'd hate to be in that position.
In a funny way, I've been a critic all my life, so I'm used to it. Remember when I was a sports writer in the 70s covering a team, and in a way, every game I covered was a critique of the game. And then that time, you have to, the next day, after you've ripped the team for a terrible performance, and I'm from Philadelphia where everybody rips everything, you had to go in the next day and face, you know, these monsters who hate you. Now, that was harder. I'll say that right now. So I am actually fine, don't have any problems facing chefs when they don't like me. There are a lot of chefs who I was friendly with who won't speak to me anymore. And what can I do? I mean, I always try to make amends if I can in the long run, and some of them just won't have it, you know. They just don't want anything to do with a guy like me. But from a home wrecker type of thing is what you're talking about. I mean, I don't usually wreck anything unless it's a disaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to subtly say I have gone to, you know, and one, you know, I've gone to restaurants even recently where I haven't particularly loved the food, but I said, you know what, it's well done, it's well made, there's a lot of earnestness in this restaurant, I'm going to give it a nice review. And even though so it's not all about what I like and what I don't like. When I rip a place to death, it's a disaster of a place, and I feel like it's a public service. I don't do it that often anymore. I may never have done it that often. I mean, every once in a while, I have memorable stories about reviews of restaurants that were so awful. I was just treated badly. The food was prepared badly. Everything about it said, this is a disaster. I don't feel bad about that. But in the sense that, do I take a hardworking, earnest, well-done restaurant that I don't think is living up to its potential and rip it to death? No, I don't do it.
Who do you feel responsible to?
You know, I that's a great question, and the answer is going to be horrible for me. I feel responsible to myself. I really consider myself a journalist. More than almost, I hope someday, it won't happen, but I wish that someday when I'm long gone, someone said, he was the best food journalist we ever saw. Not the best writer, because I'm not. Not the best critic, because I'm not. Well, I'm a pretty good critic. I want him to say he was a great journalist.
And how do you define journalism?
I know the rules of the game as well as anybody knows them. I mean, I've studied them. I teach them here. I know what's right and what's wrong. And if you follow those rules, if you never deviate, I think you can live with yourself. And it's myself I have to live with. And you know, when the story is written and I turn it in, you know, I suffer. I'm one of these guys who keeps pulling it back to change a few words. I want it to be as good as it can be. And I'm doing that. I don't know who my readers are. I mean, when you write for a national magazine, you don't have contact with your readers. Mm-hmm. I think Pete Wells, we're talking about, and he has infinite contact with people in New York, you know. And I don't have that kind of contact with readers. When I was at the beginning, when they were put a place to put blog posts on my stories, when they ran them online, everything was, I don't want to use the words here. You know, this was an era where everything was about ripping people and being nasty to people.
Right.
I don't think they do that anymore the way they used to. I don't know. Maybe they do. But I didn't even try to answer those things. Mm. You know, I thought it was insane. So I can't answer to the readers. My editors I answer to as the process is going along, but at the end, I have to satisfy myself. And I think I have very high standards of journalism.
I think you do too, Alan. The one thing I know about you is you say exactly what you feel, and you've taken your lumps for that. There, and can we get into a lump story?
Sure, go ahead.
Because it's the New Orleans piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually, didn't you play yourself in a movie?
Yes, I did.
All right. Can we go?
Nice about you.
Oh, you do?
I want to say something nice about you. After the New Orleans story, I know you got calls and letters telling you to people to fire me from this place, and you stood by me.
I did.
And I don't think you know I know that, but I know that, and I was pretty proud of you.
Why? It's just, I think, like journalism, you have a right to express what you feel, and it isn't for me to say. Now, if it was egregious and hateful, you know, what do you call it, this hate speech and all that, of course, I think there's a line of morality. But just like church and state with editorial and publishing, I thought that was in your right. But anyway, tell me about that article. Tell me in retrospect, do you wish you never wrote it? You seem to have come to make amends with Anthony Bourdain and the city of New Orleans. You played yourself in. Tell us about that, because that had to be a very difficult.
Well, the reaction to that story, I think I'm pretty tough, and I think I can take almost anything. You can tell from my life I've had an interesting life. Yeah. That was the most vicious attack on me I've ever experienced. I remember when it all came out, I was in Australia. And I had to go in, and I didn't have a computer with me, and I had to answer all these incredibly insane, you know, hate mail directed at me, and I had to answer all these queries.
So let us just, for people who don't know it,
okay, yes,
just in one sentence, kind of say what the essence of the article was.
In the aftermath of Katrina, I was a bit offended as a sort of a man who believes in a certain ethic of taking care of yourself, taking care of your city, taking care of your family, by the attitude of New Orleans. I was appalled by the city, if that makes any sense at all. I thought nobody was doing anything to bring that city back. The government there was horrible. On every level, the New Orleans government was pathetic. It still is. I mean, I'm sure the stories I heard, I remember the last one of the things that got me
riled. So this was directed at the administration and the bureaucracy, not the people living there.
No, it was directed at everybody. So I read this. I would read stories that say, New Orleans is coming back from Katrina. We just had a parade. Parades don't bring you back from tragedy. Hard work does. So I went down there. I convinced GQ to let me do the story. I went down there to write about the aftermath of Katrina, what's going on there. And I reported this for like 10 days I was down there. And I remember going everywhere and seeing one person actually cleaning up in front of their house. I mean, maybe it was too much. Maybe everybody had given up. But the city
had.
How many
years later was this?
This was a year later.
1 year later.
Yeah. Well, it came out of, I'm trying to think of the, I'm not sure. Maybe it was, I went down there and it's 8 months and it came out a year later. Or maybe I was there a year later. But it was around that time. I was just offended by that. I mean, I was appalled. I mean, people got their money for recovery money and went out to restaurants and spent it there. I just didn't see anybody putting their heart into bringing this city back. Just they talked about it, they paraded about it, and I wrote that story. How disappointed I was with New Orleans.
What did your editors say? Because it was for GQ, right?
Yes, it was for GQ.
And so, how did your editor react to that?
I thought they were okay. They did some editing. Some of it I liked. Some of it I didn't like. I remember they changed certain things they wanted changed, and I wasn't always for it, and some of it I was for. I don't know if it made any real difference in the reaction. I mean, I have to take credit or blame for that story. Mm-hmm. I'd love to blame my editors, but I probably can't. Everybody loves to blame editors. It ended up having incredible recovery. I mean, can I use a funny word?
You can use any word.
I mean, if you Googled back then, me and my name and New Orleans, you would come up with a story. Said Alan Richmond is a penis. That was the big word that everybody was using. I mean, everybody just wanted to call me names down there. And in fact, that guy who wrote that story ended up saying, "Listen, you hate me. I made a deal with him where he would send me questions and I would answer them. I said, "You send me every question you want. I'm going to answer them on your website. And afterwards, you cannot change a thing I say, but you can then, afterwards, you read them, you can say anything you want about me."
So and how did that go off?
Went off very well. He stuck to his guns. I was very impressed. He let me write all my answers to everything, and then he said, he kind of softened a little bit, you know, because he asked me a lot of questions like I hadn't done my work down there, and I had. Mm-hmm. Look, I could be completely wrong, but you know, I was just appalled. It really came from the heart, if you want to say that. People would say from the gut, maybe.
Would you do it again?
Yes.
Really?
I would.
Why?
Because it was journalism. It was, would I do it, would it come out the same way if I went down there? I don't know. Maybe I would try to look more. I spent a lot of time there. If I had seen things or heard things or learned things, that made me want to feel more compassionate toward the city. I would have been more compassionate toward the city. I did not set out to write that kind of piece. I set out to write a piece, what's going on down there? Why is it so awful? I have to have open minds. I certainly wasn't out there. And the piece, I thought the piece was actually kind of what a person really knows about their writing. Mm. But no one thought it was funny. I mean, I had many people who felt the same way as me about New Orleans, you know, say, yes, it was. I got a lot of laughs out of it. I mean, you know, and I put in things in there that were odd. Like, I had a whole paragraph about there being no such thing as Creoles, which made everybody crazy down there. Mm. And the New York Times had a front page of the food section's story on me saying there's no such thing as Creoles. And they came to the conclusion is maybe there aren't any such things as Creoles anymore. So it was huge. You know, Bourdain went nuts over it, which started a 5-year feud with Bourdain.
How did that resolve?
He won. I'll tell you what the story was. I didn't mind the fact that Bourdain called me names and was horrible. I minded the fact that people respected this form of communications. In other words, I was the bad guy, and Bourdain was the good guy. And, you know the way he speaks. Now, I ended up saying, I finally remember one story years later, I said, I concede. I'm 19th century man against 21st century man, meaning Bourdain. And what he says and the way he acts, by the way, he's a brilliant person. Nothing about what he said was casual or unthoughtful, you know, but it was a little disgusting, I thought, the way he
referred to you.
Yeah, the way he referred to me. And I don't think people should cherish that. But nevertheless, he knew what he was doing, and I didn't. He knows how to pick that battle. I mean, we later, we're not friends, but we're friendly now.
Yeah, I know. He was at your roast.
Eric Repair made him come to the roast. You know what happened there?
What?
I heard this.
There was a roast at Le Bernardin for Alan, put on by GQ a year or two ago?
Yeah,
18 months ago?
No, it was to celebrate my 25 years at GQ.
Yeah.
And people said, who do you want for the roast? I said, you got to get Bourdain. And Eric said, are you crazy? He hates you. I said, that's what makes it good. I don't want this to be one of those phony roasts. I had gone down and played myself on Tremé, which was, Bourdain was a big part of that HBO series. And at first I wasn't going to do it. And the producer, they were great. They said, look, if there's anything he writes about you, in writing that up, and you don't like it, you don't have to say it. You could change it. So I went down, I did it. It worked out great. Then they were having the roast.
You were playing yourself, the reporter that trashed New Orleans.
Yeah, the reporter who trashed New Orleans, who is found in a restaurant by a New Orleans chef who throws a Sazerac in my face. That was the story.
And did you lick your lips after?
It wasn't a real Sazerac. Yeah, it wasn't the real thing. You know, can I tell you, you want to hear about how they did that?
Sure.
They're
wait
so
a minute, I got to cut to a commercial, but we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Alan Richman, and he is a world award-winning journalist, food journalist. Okay, Alan, so how did they do the Sazerac scene?
Oh, they're so smart. I mean, everybody, you deal with these smart people. So I'm sitting at a table with a couple of friends, and they have a bunch of suits for me because they're going to throw the drink in my face a few times, and I'm going to change, and we're going to try it again until we get it right. And the director comes over and says, okay, everybody, we're going to move it up to the point where she throws the drink in his face, but we're going to stop there. And we're going to film up to there. So, and he says, of course, he says to the chef who's going to throw it in his face. So I didn't know it was coming.
Right.
And it turned out to be the take they used, of course, because they got the right reaction, astonishment from me. I mean, that's smart people at work. It was really,
I think they've done it before.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on.
By the way, can I tell you this?
Yeah.
Bourdain came to the show because Eric Repair said to him, you know, they're the greatest of artists. Says, yeah. Richman came down and did your show. You come and do Richman's show.
Oh.
Yeah, it was very nice.
Well, I was there, and I thought the it was very civilized.
It was brilliant.
It was brilliant.
They can watch it.
It's on YouTube?
I think it is.
Okay. Look it up. It's probably Alan Richman Roast, 25 years. Anthony Bourdain. It was really great. So moving on, I want to ask you two questions. What is your favorite article, food article or chef article that you have written in your career? And what's the one article you want to write?
Well, the favorite article is easy. I did a story called The Last Days of the Old Jewish Waiters. And that was my favorite story. It was about, you know, there was a great tradition of Jewish waiters on the Lower East Side, where all these guys who came off the boats and wanted to be musicians or artists or writers ended up as waiters. And they were bitter. and they were here for decades in all these Jewish restaurants on the Lower East Side. And when I decided to do this article about 15 years ago, there were still a few left, and that was all. And I just loved doing that article so much. I remember I had my father in that article, who grew up in the Lower East Side, and said, I hated them all. They had bad attitudes, and they wiped the table with a dish rag they kept under their armpits. But I just loved doing that article. So, it was up for a Beard, MFK Fisher, Dames Beard, Best Writing Award, and it didn't win. And I'm still mad about it.
Resubmit it. They'll forget.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And what would I like to write today? Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know that I have, you know, something burning in me. I am lucky. I mean, I'm basically a restaurant guy more than I am anything else. And I've been to all the great restaurants, and you know, I haven't been to all the new, the Noma style restaurants. I've been there, and I wrote about Rene Redzepi. So I can't say there's anything left. I mean, there are plenty of stories to do. As you've been talking about here, it's changing so much. The restaurant world is changing so much. I would love to go right now on the small scale. I would love to go to all the cities in America, you know, the smaller ones, and see what the restaurant scene is there. Because if I'm right that it's expanding everywhere, they should have wonderful restaurants. One of the frustrations of my life as a journalist, and it goes back throughout my life, is not getting to small town America. And, you know, and seeing what they're doing there, what they're eating there, how they're living there. I love that. I always want to take a Greyhound bus across America and write about every stop. Not now, I don't. I think the Greyhound buses ain't what they used to be. But in my day, they were. And I want to, you know, the stories I want to write are the stories on the people level, of the small people doing their work in their shops and whatever they do. And that still has always filled me with joy. You know, and I never get to do enough of that. It's hard to find a place to do it. When I was a city columnist for the Boston Globe, and I did some stories there that I'm so proud of, because I remember one story about a crippled man who was arrested for selling tickets, you know, what do you call it now? Lottery tickets, you know, run by organized crime. And I went and interviewed him, and he said, well, I'm only doing this because organized crime is the only people who would give me a job. You know, those kind of stories, they're just fantastic. I wrote a story when I was in Boston about a kid who stole a car, and it was $25,000 in the glove compartment of the car, and what he did with the money. I mean, those are the stories, you know, you want to write, and I want to do them with food. But the stories of America is what I yearn to do and always have.
So I said that I know, because I've gone out to eat with you only a couple of times. I'm waiting like David Chang, take me to La Bernardin. That when you walk into a restaurant, they know who you are. You're not, you know, hidden under a hat or a beard. And they, you know, they're nervous. And so what's the formula? Is there a formula that you look for in a restaurant? Is there something after eating in all these restaurants you'd like to say to chefs in general about how they, you know, what you think a restaurant and a chef in a restaurant should be? Is there any distilled wisdom? That's what I'm asking.
The great wisdom I have after eating in so many restaurants is the answer. What I would like to say to chefs is what they don't want to hear. The answer to a good restaurant is for you to be there. And that happens less and less. I mean, without that, you know, I even think a place we're talking about, La Bernardin. Mm. You know, Eric Repair has been there, what, 20 years? He's been the head chef for 15. I'm just guessing at this. It wasn't until about 6 or 7 years ago that I thought the restaurant was just as good without him there than it was with him there. Mm-hmm. It took him years to get it that good. So when a chef is not in a restaurant, you can tell the difference every time, you know? And in fact, I was eating at Del Posto, and I had this great meal. And what's his name?
Not Ladner. Brooks Hadley? No. Joe Bastianich.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Joe
Bastianich, who doesn't like me. I was in there, I was eating, and I had brought another guy in there who, Sam Sifton I had brought in, big food guy, and to eat. And we were in there, and we had, you know, I didn't think it was very good when it first opened up. It was like a 2-star restaurant at best. And I said to Joe, this is a great meal. I haven't had a better meal in New York all year. And he looked at me and with this grouchy look on his face, and he said, "No, what do you expect? The chef is cooking every dish for you." And I thought that became my definition of what 4-star dining should be, one where it tastes like the chef is cooking every dish for you.
What a great statement.
Yeah. And I remember that was, but they've got to be there. And nothing, let's assume, if they're not there, forget it. It isn't going to happen. It isn't going to be a great restaurant. It just is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, if he is there, what do I want for him? I just think that the restaurants I don't like have no imagination at all. I mean, there's a lot of restaurants open up in New York, these chain restaurants, that seem just like every other restaurant that came before. But most chefs have imagination. If they have the money and they have the imagination and the time, I don't know if they're a good chef, I don't know how they can have a bad restaurant. When I come in, you talk about a good or a bad attitude when you go into a restaurant. Every restaurant I go into where I know the chef is there, or maybe, you know, in the case of Alain Ducasse, he puts in great chefs in place, and he's not always there. So he's one of the few who have pulled that off, by the way.
New York.
Yes, not in New York. They weren't. I'm talking about around in France, you know, yes, in Monaco. You're right. They all closed in there, but they weren't.
Who do you write for, the French or Americans?
They weren't that bad, these Ducasse. Already did some stupid things, you know, pick your
the
knife.
The pens, whatever it was.
Right, yeah.
No, he's brilliant. Yeah. Blazatine is brilliant, but they didn't work in New York.
They didn't work here, but they weren't terrible here. I mean,
no.
At worst, they were 3-star restaurants.
The bill was terrible. this is too much fun. We've run out of time.
Oh, okay.
But you know what? For my second 100th show, you know, you can come back after I do 100 more.
Thank
you know,
you. How many? When is that? Will I still be
probably
alive?
2 years?
We have a shot.
Yeah, we have a shot.
Thank you,
Alan. It's always fun. And tell everybody where they can read all of your body of work.
Well, you know, they've sort of cataloged it all somewhere. I can't find it, but if you're better than I am, you could probably find a lot of my stuff on GQ.com or just Google my name and the articles.
Google his name in GQ, but I'll tell you my favorite article that you ever wrote.
Oh, wow.
It's when you put yourself in Eritrea and spent a week with the French Foreign Legion, seeing they ate.
You got everything right, but the country. Yes, it was Djibouti.
Oh, Djibouti. Sorry, excuse me. They're close, right?
Yeah, they're very close. You're on the right track anyway. Oh, you read, you love that article. I'm glad to hear that. I suffered. Can I tell you a story about that?
Sure, Anthony Bourdain's happy to hear it.
Want to hear the last story about that?
Yeah.
I was so careful with my... Djibouti should not exist as a country. No one should live there. There's nothing there.
New Orleans, don't you feel good now? You're not alone.
I stayed on this outpost. I wasn't even in Djibouti City. I was on an outpost where if the Ethiopia invaded Djibouti, they would go right past this French Foreign Legion outpost, and we'd all stand them off. And there were leopards outside. There was leopards in a cage and hyenas, and it was just monstrously awful. And I was so careful with my eating. Okay,
there to do a food article.
I know,
right?
But I ate when the Foreign Legion went out in the field. I ate their food, but when I wasn't, I was so careful. I didn't want to get sick.
Okay.
I'm very careful not getting sick when I'm traveling. The last day, the wife of the commander of the outpost invites me to lunch, and puts out a green salad.
With vinaigre, bien sûr.
And what do you? Come on, what would you do? What would you do? What would you do, Dorothy?
I take the bottle of Evian and dip the lettuce leaves in it.
I said, okay, I got it. They were so nice to me. I ate the salad.
And
I was sick all the way home on the plane for like 24 hours. I was just in the bathroom of the plane.
Oh, I tell you, that's just made Anthony Bourdain's day. Oh, my gosh. What you do for journalism, Alan,
I thank you.
The public thanks you. And we can't wait to have you back.
Thank you, Dorothy, so much.
Thank you. All right. I'd like to thank Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee, our producers, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.